The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. On today's show, we're going to have part two of my conversation with Professor John Pfaff. John Pfaff, he's a professor of law at Fordham Law School. He's the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. Let's get to it. What can we do to move forward in a progressive way and to start resolving some of these problems? Actually, how do we achieve real reform?
Yeah, I mean, so I will admit that of the chapters in my book, the last chapter focused on reforms is probably the weakest, and I'm okay with that because I don't think we've really thought hard enough in a wide-ranging kind of way about how to respond to a lot of these issues, right? So my three main points is that we need to focus much more on prosecutors than on long sentences. We need to focus much more on how we respond to violence than how we respond to drugs. And we need to focus a lot more on sort of the public sector issues rather than private prisons. The private prisons are kind of this sideshow relative to the much greater power of the public sector, right? Only about 8% of all people are held in private prisons. And while private prisons get about $3 billion in revenue and make about $300 million in profit, the payroll, just the payroll for the public sector prison system is on the order of $30 billion, right? So 10 times the revenue of the private prisons and 100 times the profit of private prisons is just the payroll component to the public sector. And many of these prisons are located in fairly remote areas where the prison, as awful a job as being a prison correctional officer is, and correctional officers, you know, they have levels of PTSD and suicidal ideation that rival combat veterans who have seen active combat. It's still oftentimes the only decent job in the area. And even more complicated is, especially in the South, oftentimes those communities that have the prisons, where the prison is the one good job, they actually tend to be more heavily minority than other similarly situated small towns in the rural South, because that's why that town asked for the prison, because they couldn't get other good jobs to come there. And so the racial justice implications of decarceration and prison closures in the South is even substantially more intractable than elsewhere. And so, you know, it's possible things are various policy fixes for these things, and there's lots of small, subtle things I think we can do and some bigger things. But I think in many ways, my views have shifted a bit since the book came out, to realize that at the end of the day, there are a lot of policy fixes. We should do a lot of these policy fixes. But none of these policy problems that I identify and try to fix, that other people are identifying and trying to fix, all of them predate mass incarceration by a substantial mark, like by decades, if not like a century, right? And so none of them caused mass incarceration, right? They facilitated trends once those trends got started, but something else got the ball rolling. And I think it's helpful to think of mass incarceration as far more a political, ideological failure than a policy failure, right? And it's about how do we change the way we just think about things? And I think two really striking examples of this, right? Sort of the dominant sort of political model we face these days is, you know, we have these elected prosecutors, elected judges, we have parole boards who respond to elected governors. No other country in the world does it this way. We're the only country in the world with elected prosecutors. We're the only country in the world with elected judges. Certainly compared to Europe, we're the only country where parole boards respond to an elected governor as opposed to being part of a completely politically independent judiciary, right? And so our criminal justice system is just much more sensitive to political shocks than other systems are. And so the classic example of this is, you know, the famous Willie Horton story, right? So Massachusetts, like actually 40 some other states and the feds in the 70s and 80s, had these furlough programs that would allow people in prison to go home on the weekend to see their family, to stay connected, start looking for jobs in anticipation of release. And in the Massachusetts case, even let people like Horton, who had been convicted of felony murder, so it's not clear he did the killing, but was part of a group of people who killed someone, who was serving a life sentence with parole, but still a very long sentence, to go home. Horton didn't go home. At one point, on one of his releases, Horton ran off, fled down to Maryland, broke into a home, committed a vicious assault and rape on the people living in the home, and gets rearrested. Now, Horton was a tremendous outlier by Massachusetts standards. At the time that this happened in the mid-80s, there was actually an article pointing out that over 99% of all people furloughed in Massachusetts came back without incident. Right? So the program as a whole worked. But those successes aren't politically salient. The failures are. And Willie Horton got turned into what was viewed at the time, although by 2018 standards is not really so bad, as one of like the most racist campaign ads during the George H.W. Bush, Michael Dukakis presidential election. And even though the actual impact of Horton on Dukakis' performance is generally oversold, right? The lesson people took away is if you have one mistake, you're going to get punished for it. So don't take any chances. Just lock everybody up. But here's the interesting thing. Several years before, there had been another case exactly like Horton, a state with a furlough program release. And I should point out that by the time the dust settled from the Horton case, every state and the feds had abolished their furlough programs. They don't exist anymore at all, right? They're gone because of the sensationalism around the Willie Horton case. But about 15 years before that, the exact same thing happened. Someone gets furloughed, leaves the prison, commits, in this case, a murder, gets rearrested. Law enforcement demands that the state cut the furlough program. This is lawlessness and anarchy. And the governor gets up, and yeah, he fires ahead of the furlough program and tightens the rules a little bit. But he says, look, these furloughs are an incredibly important aspect of rehabilitation. I'm not going to let this one act derail a successful program. And that, you know, progressive-minded governor was Ronald Reagan in California. Right. And so we're at a level now where we're actually less progressive than Ronald Reagan was in the 70s. Even more striking, there was a governor many years before that who furloughed for the holidays for Christmas. She allowed one third of the prison population out of prison to go home for the holidays. And then 15 people didn't come back. And the media actually said, that's fine, right? Like, this is a great idea. You know, my guess is that the average random citizen wouldn't have returned at the same successful rate. Like, this is important. Let's maintain this program. And that was Alabama in the 30s, right? And so we're at this point, we're actually more punitive than the Jim Crow South, which is, on the one hand, profoundly depressing, right? On the other hand, it really highlights the fact that with all the defects in place, Ronald Reagan and the Jim Crow South didn't do what we're doing now. And so we don't have to do this. And suggest that you don't necessarily need to get the legislature to actually change all of our laws and fix all these defects, right? It's about our willingness to change what we demand from our officials, right? And the double-edged sword of the vast discretion we grant police and the vast discretion we grant prosecutors is that while they have in recent history used it to be harsh, they can use it not to be, right? And they can simply stop making arrests, right? They can simply stop arresting marijuana cases, even though the state legislature can't bring itself to repeal the law, right? They can simply stop prosecuting cases, even if the legislature will keep them on the book. And so it's a kind of question about how do we get people's attitudes to shift? And that's an incredibly difficult question. But my concern is that if you change all the policy issues, the system adapts very smoothly, and you can fix one defect and people will just shift their views and people shift their actions and kind of get back to where they always wanted to be all along. But if you change their attitudes, you actually don't have to change the underlying policies at all. We can just use the discretion we already have to do better things. And I think we're starting to see drifts in that direction. Even when it comes to violence, we're starting to see efforts to embrace less harsh, less punitive, more street-level intervention, preventative approaches, more restorative justice approaches, more public health approaches. Like, these shifts are happening, and they're slow, and they're tenuous, and it wouldn't take much of a spike in crime, I think, to undo many of them. But it suggests to me that there's some hope there that we really are starting to, I think of sort of how do you address the underlying ideology of this more than the policy of it.
Drug courts, which you mentioned, are a good example. They were sold as make the so much smoother, and the courts have less pressure. And I watched the arrests, the number of drug arrests, and the number of drug courts, and there was they rose alongside. I mean, it seemed that it was easier to process, so they just processed more. I mean, it was a great idea until it backfired. You can correct me on that if you'd like. I that was at least my perception back then. It seemed
I'm not too up to date on sort of the exact stats on this, but there is this general concern people have with what's called, you know, net widening, right? That when you introduce an alternative, it doesn't divert people from prison to the alternative. We just take more people we would have otherwise dropped out of the system and pull them into the alternative, right? I think what drives, you know, net widening is not inevitable, right? But I think if you try to create alternatives in a system that defaults automatically to punitiveness, right? We're just going to use that to pull more people in, right? If you create alternatives to a system that genuinely doesn't want to punish anymore in the same way that we do, then I think it wouldn't lead to net widening, right? It's not necessarily these net widening effects are an inevitable result of creating alternatives to traditional punishment. It's that if either the officials or the public or both start from a presumption of punitiveness, that is how they're going to use the alternatives. And if you don't change that underlying attitude, you're not going to change sort of the underlying behavior. And I wouldn't say we're far along the path to changing attitudes. I just saw something the other day about a community in Virginia that, you know, last year passed an ordinance saying that the punishment for if you trick-or-treated over the age of 12 or if you trick-or-treated after 8 p.m. at night, regardless of age, you would face like up to it was a misdemeanor offense, punishable by up to $100 fine and 30 days in jail, right? Like how do you people stop knocking on doors at 9 o'clock at night? Well, I guess we arrest them because what else could we possibly do, right? And so you know, our punitiveness is still it's very deep and instinctive, and you know you certainly see it anytime people point to disparities in punishment. You know, why is Manafort getting this number of years when somebody who's doing less is getting far more years? The adjective there is always motivated from a position of everybody should get the longer sentence, not everybody should get the shorter sentence, right? And so we have a very, very long way to go from moving away from the harshness that we've almost come to accept at a profoundly instinctual almost kind of level. But if we don't do that, then I think like with drug courts and everything else, people, you know, punitive actors will figure out ways to work around reforms to preserve the punitiveness that they want to impose.
You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. This is a conversation with Professor John Pfaff. He is a professor of law at Fordham Law School, and he's the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. Now let's get back to that conversation with John Pfaff. So that's the limitations of reform. The system co-opts makes a couple of minor adjustments enough to keep people get people to calm down and stop making trouble, and then continues on with the same attitude.
Exactly.
What are you working on? What are you now working on? This book was a you said you've shifted your thinking. Are you on a new project, or is just what are you up to now?
Yeah, so my next project isn't so much about the policy versus politics point I brought up, but I'm still thinking through that. It's actually, I'm trying to undertake a study to really get a sense of what is the full social cost of incarceration, right? Usually when we talk about the cost of prisons, we say, you know, we're spending about $50 billion a year in prison, we spend about $30 billion a year on jail, but those aren't really the right costs to think about, and in part because they're not entirely costs, right? You know, about two-thirds of that spending on prisons, and I think even a greater fraction of the spending on jails, is wages, right? And wages aren't entirely costs. They're this strange Keynesian multiplier thing that I didn't do well enough in graduate school in economics to fully grasp, but right? They're not entirely costs. The real social costs of prison is the fact, you know, perhaps people go to prison, they come out, they earn less, right? That they're physically and sexually assaulted while they're in prison, that the risk of death from a drug overdose skyrockets upon release from prison. And that's true in the United States as much as in like Germany and Holland. Like, it's just a universal nature of prisons that drug overdose deaths go up significantly within the first several weeks on release from prison. Now, overall, one study in New York State suggested that in the short to medium term, 1 year in prison cut 2 years off your expected lifespan. You know, families are weakened and strained. There's shame and stigma. You know, there's health costs. Prisons are vectors of tuberculosis and STDs and HIV. You know, so what is sort of this total sort of human cost of punishment? And remarkably, despite the fact that from the 80s to today, we've made probably close to half a billion arrests and admitted about 20 million people to prison, though not all unique people. And despite this massive social experiment that we've engaged in sort of this mass punishment unseen anywhere in the world or unseen even in our own history, we've never bothered to actually figure out what the real costs of it are. And so my next goal is really to try to understand what are the actual, like, not financial costs, but the actual, like, human costs of what we're doing. And once you see those human costs, you know, I think it's going to put, you know, whatever punitive benefits prisons have and punishment has more broadly, right, we need to be able to put them in proper sort of context. I think this is the key contextual piece that we just don't have.
Fascinating. So just in looking, but primarily at the prisons, not because, I mean, obviously law enforcement would be an even, it's my harangue has been for the longest time that looking at the costs of enforcement on drug laws, there's research out of England showing that it took an average of about 2 hours of police time to take care of one simple possession arrest. So, you know, they just did the math and saw how many police hours were being spent just dealing with possession. I thought that was, you know, give me your opinion, please, because I think that's a reasonably strong argument. On the other hand, it runs into the you know, backfiring about, you know, I don't know. What do you think about that kind of argument?
Well, looking at sort of police allocation and the cost of that, I mean, I think that's a legitimate question, right? I oftentimes, you know, if we're going to look at, you know, sort of, you know, we often hear about this idea of sort of high, you know, communities which have high rates of crime are still, you know, sort of, especially communities, poor communities of color are over-policed. And my perspective on that is better to think of it as mispoliced, right? That the police spend too much of their time focusing on low-level stuff while our homicide clearance rate is abysmal, right, for the offense, right? You know, this is actually a point that Jill Leovi makes in her great book, Ghetto Side. And she points out that the clearance rate for homicides in L.A. County as a whole, she's an L.A. Times reporter, who's embedded with a homicide unit in the South Central part of Los Angeles for several years. And she points out, you know, the clearance rate, how many murders and homicides result in an arrest? And for L.A. County as a whole, it's about 60%, which is about the national average. About 2/3 of all murders produce an arrest, about 1/3 of murders never see anyone arrested for them. But in L.A. County, if the victim was a black man, that clearance rate drops from 60% to 30%. Right? So 2/3 of all murders of a black man produce no arrest at all. Right? And her sense is that a lot of the antagonism, the frustration and hostility that South Central, African Americans in particular in South Central felt towards the police, a lot of it, not all of it, obviously there's lots of things going on, but one non-trivial part of it was their sense of, why are you making these drug arrests while, you know, my son's homicide goes unsolved, right? And if we could focus on those homicide offenses, that could actually have some real benefits, right? And so there's this gross misallocation of policing that takes place. And so I think, you know, focusing on sort of those costs is absolutely spot on as well. I would just say, you know, in terms of my project, I'm focusing just on prisons because the way I describe it to my students is, you know, the criminal justice system is kind of a giant burning sun of failure, right? And if you try to stare at the whole thing at once, you're going to go blind. And so you have to pick your one little sliver of it, put on, like, you know, your eclipse glasses and stare at that one little bit as best as you can, and trust that other people are going to study the other parts and try to fix the other parts. And if I were to try to measure the entire social cost of punishment, arrests, electronic monitoring, jail time, probation, parole, prisons, sex offense registries, all that, my grandchildren wouldn't live long enough, I think, to get it done. And so I've chosen to focus on the prison part just because that's the area I'm most familiar with. Also, like, I just if you don't limit your analysis, it becomes impossible. And that said, I think it is important. We talk a lot about mass incarceration, trying to change mass incarceration in this country. And as someone who studied prisons, you know, his whole life, I get that. But mass incarceration and mass punishment are two very different things. And what, you know, in many ways, while prison gets all the attention, it's very much just the tip of the iceberg, right? You know, I think one thing that confuses people is the way you hear the statistic is that we have about 1.5 million people in prison and about 750,000 people in jail. And those are one-day counts. On December 31st, how many people do we have in these facilities? It's about 1.5 million, 750,000. But the catch is that jail, which is used primarily for pretrial detention, has massive turnover in a way that prisons that are used for felony convictions that generally have a sentence of a year or more are not. And so we have a prison population of about 1.5 million. We admit about 600,000 people to prison every year. On any given day, there are about 750,000 people in jail, but we make 10 million jail admissions annually. And one recent study suggests that about 5 million unique people make up those 10 million people each year, right? And so the actual impact of jail is far vaster than the impact of prison, because it impacts far more people. 10 times as many people get admitted to jail every year, unique people get admitted to jail every year than get admitted to prisons every year. You know, we make somewhere between 10 to 12 million arrests. And again, not all unique people, but a lot of them are, right? And as you work your way down the system, different things matter more, right? So, you know, we make about, you know, drug arrests are one of the larger drug arrest category. About slightly more than 10% of all arrests are for drugs, and a large fraction of those are for marijuana. But marijuana makes about 1% of all prison population, right? And so decriminalizing or legalizing marijuana will probably have next to no impact on prisons. But it can have a significant impact on arrests. It can have a bigger impact on jails. Like, each of these institutions impacts different communities and different offenses and different strategies in different kinds of ways. And so I've increasingly found myself using this term mass punishment to say, look, arrests, mass arrests, that doesn't inevitably lead to mass jail. And mass jail doesn't necessarily lead to mass incarceration. And even to the extent that they are connected to each other, they're sorting people and impacting communities and people in different kinds of ways, each of which demands its own type of attention. And so I'm focusing on prisons, and I want to make it very clear that my prison results won't say tell us about the jail or the policing parts. Those are other aspects that demand their own separate analysis.
That's an interesting. That's a great mass punishment, and that gets to the big question from before, and that's how do you change the attitudes? Because mass punishment is less about policy and more about the attitudes that are driving the policy.
Right, and so I think a lot of it is about actually paying attention to these down ticket elections. Right, you know, we've started to acknowledge the importance of the prosecutor. That's fantastic. But now we're starting to realize that, you know, if you just change the prosecutor, but not the judges, that can be a problem. That's what's happening. You know, Krasner's finding that problem in Philadelphia, where a lot of the judges are resisting his changes. Chicago has tried to change its bail courts, and the judges are balking there. Also, it suggests that, you know, especially outside of cities, once you get into more rural America, you know, sheriff elections matter tremendously. So the sheriff, like the DA, is a county elected official. They run the jail. Outside of incorporated towns, they make all the arrests. And so in rural America, they are hugely powerful and sort of utterly unremovable absent election. There's actually one sheriff somewhere, I don't know where. He is actually currently under indictment for trying to hire a hitman to kill one of his own deputies who had whistleblown on him. He's also still the sheriff because there's no way to make him step down while he is investigated for attempting to murder one of his own deputies. There's another case in Alabama, which actually had this old, ancient Great Depression era provision that would actually allow sheriffs to keep whatever money they had for jails and didn't spend. They could keep it for themselves. And there, these sheriffs are basically buying summer homes while feeding the people in their jails food that was labeled like not fit for human consumption, right? And so they had tremendous impact on day-to-day lives of people in their jails and their communities. And again, like prosecutors 10 years ago, they have generally flown beneath the radar and only now starting to get attention, right? And I think sort of trying to really mobilize people to understand, like, you get to make these choices, and these people have tremendous power over day-to-day lives, and really get people to get energized about that. And I think there are a lot of groups that are really starting to take that seriously, and groups that are starting to work hard to mobilize communities to get more involved and take these elections a lot, you know, to actually get out the vote and make these elections count.
Sheriff, by the way, that you're referring to is in Granville County, North Carolina. USA Today article from, this looks like September. North Carolina sheriff has been indicted for allegedly plotting to kill one of his deputies after learning the man had a tape of him making, quote, racially offensive, end quote, comments. Indicted Monday, 2 counts felony obstruction, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Still the sheriff.
God. Mass punishment. Fascinating. Fascinating. Yeah, again, folks, Professor John Pfeff, PhD, JD, professor of law at Fordham College of Law, your book here, Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. Fantastic. Terrific book. What else do you have? What else is on your radar? What are the kinds of stuff you're looking at?
I mean, that's sort of, I mean, project-wise, is obviously this cost of prisons project. You know, otherwise, it's you know, I guess the thing that's sort of the other issue it's not my area of research, but I find most interesting is really thinking more carefully about how we frame reform efforts, because we sort of have this story about, you know, we get very focused on rehabilitation until we overreach, and then we swing back to being punitive until we overreach, and we swing back. It's kind of sort of this inevitably swinging pendulum. And there's actually a great book I read last year called Breaking the Pendulum that argues that that's the wrong way to think about it. And the real way it happens, that's how things look ex post. But at the time, what's happening is that during any period of sort of reform, like the tough on crime people are there sort of trying to lay the trap to sort of push us back in a tough on crime direction. And even in the most tough on crime phase, like, you know, progressive reformers are there, perhaps with little to no attention, but they're trying to sort of build a framework to push things in a more progressive direction when sort of more macro level conditions change the political story. And I think often it's like a concern that the reform effort is falling into those traps. And I think one example of that is one of the ways they often frame sort of, especially the decarceration efforts, they keep saying, and this has been for years true, right, that look at all these states. They've been cutting their prison populations and their crime rate has been falling. Therefore, it's safe to cut prisons. Therefore, we should keep doing it. The challenge of that framing is that it suggests that if crime goes up, the justification for prison cutting goes down. And that's actually not true, right? Prison's a bad response to crime, whether crime is going up or going down. We know with practical certainty that there are far better ways to respond to crime than prisons, right? Even if you're not an abolitionist, right? Even if you're not saying we should get rid of prisons altogether, right? We should focus far, far, far more on non-prison interventions than where we are today than on prison as a way to respond to rising crime, right? But this framing, which I get the politics of it, look, things are good, let's keep doing things while things are good, sets up this implicit message that when things get bad, maybe the argument for decarceration goes away, and then that exactly happened. Alaska passed this really sweeping reform bill. In the next year, for reasons completely unrelated to that crime bill, crime went up, and they immediately repealed the whole bill, including half the provisions that had not yet even gone into effect, and therefore could not explain the crime rise, right? Because it was kind of sold as like, look, we can do this because crime is going down. When crime went up, they undid it, right? And I think there's a lot to be said about sort of how do we think about sort of the political framing of what sort of an effort to scale back punishment is, because, you know, we want to be careful not to slip into kind of a framework that actually ends up sort of doing the tough on crime component's job for them, because it's completely clear that as a purely public safety policy matter, tough on crime is not the right way to respond, but it's a very easy political path to go down.
Professor John Pfeff, author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform, professor of law at Fordham College of Law. For now, that's it. I want to thank Professor Pfeff for being my guest. I want to thank you for listening. This has been Century of Lies. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.